Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 12th, 2002. Today's session is titled, The Impact of International Trafficking and Prostitution, presented by Gail Gamuth McCoy. The tape number is GAG-2002-01. Let's listen in.
Pretty difficult topic and a fairly controversial one. My name is Gail Gamuth McCoy, and I'm the executive director of Genesis House in Chicago. We are the largest organization in the United States today that rehabilitates women and girls in prostitution, and we offer what we call wraparound services about that, which is all the way from first contact, which includes street, court, jail programming, through crisis, through case management and counseling, through long-term rehabilitation. We have a 70% success rate in rehabilitating the women. We were featured in Time magazine for that fact. What we will do is talk about Genesis House will be the last topic, and that will be given on Friday. I plan to have this series from macro issues, international trafficking, and prostitution as a human rights issue and a human rights concern, and then take it through to Genesis House and show you why in the United States, with what goes on in this country, it continues to be a human rights concern. And some of the issues we'll touch on throughout this series is, for example, the current interest in and about pedophilia and how we fail to protect our children in this country. Most children, many children, do not come from healthy families. We'll talk about the fact that runaways are approached within 48 hours at a bus station to be a prostitute. So even though today we're talking about international trafficking and those implications, we'll get to the specifics in the United States and what the real sociology is around prostitution. Also, before I start, I will tell you that Genesis House stands firmly against legalization of prostitution, and we'll explain to you along the way why we're against legalizing prostitution, although I would imagine most people would pretty much know why we don't want to legalize prostitution. But we'll talk about the underlying social causes of prostitution, why those are the things that we really need to work on and try and help in this country. So first of all, this is the one thing I'm really going to have to read. It is the definition of trafficking under the UN protocol. And I do have to say that Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright did a lot of work in this area, which was to be commended. And now, post-September 11th, because of what's going on with immigration and the INS and visas and all those kinds of things, there's a lot less momentum to really work on international trafficking because the focus has really shifted since September 11th. But it is defined by the UN as the recruitment, transportation, transfer, harboring, or receipt of persons by means of the threat or use of force or other forms of coercion, of abduction, of fraud, of deception, of the abuse of power or of a position of vulnerability, or the giving or receiving of payments or benefits to achieve the consent of a person having control over another person for the purpose of exploitation. So you can see that's fairly broad, but it's all fairly negative and illegal behaviors. Exploitations shall include, at a minimum, the exploitation of the prostitution of others, or other forms of sexual exploitation, forced labor or services, slavery or practices similar to slavery, servitude, or the removal of organs. And I think most of you know now, too, there's a huge black market for the removal of organs, and this comes under this law and this trafficking. So right now we're looking at trafficking today in this world is viewed as the largest manifestation of slavery in the world today, and it's clearly defined by the UN as slavery, and in our most modern terms. Trafficking is distinguished from alien smuggling, which is a little bit different. So for our purposes of our lecture today, alien smuggling is with the knowledge of the person paying to come into this country and knowing that they're trying to get into the United States by some form of payment. So we are not talking about that. We're talking clearly about trafficking today. So not people who knowingly buy passport to another country, which of course a lot of that, even though that's they're knowingly getting into it, we do know a lot of stories about people that are detained, found in boxcars, found dead in boxcars. So it's not any better in terms of human rights. It's just not our topic for today. So what is the scope of the problem worldwide? How many people do you think are trafficked for prostitution and forced labor? Well, actually, it's the largest and the fastest growing income right now for international organized crime, and it is now only number three behind guns and drugs. So, and one of those reasons is that a person is, in many respects, the gift that keeps on giving. It's not a one-time drug deal or a one-time trade for guns. Once you have that person in servitude, you continue to use them for financial purposes and to get income from that individual. So it goes on and on and on until that person runs away or dies or the INS catches them or something like that. It's a concern to U.S. administration, to Congress, to the international community. And I also want to tell you that also men and boys are trafficked. We'll focus mostly on women and girls today because it is predominantly women and girls. And when boys and men are trafficked, it's normally for forced labor. It's rarely for, not as often anyway, for prostitution. The official estimates vary of how many people every year are trafficked, because there's no real way to count this or see exactly what's happening. But the estimates are anywhere from 700,000 people to 1 million annually. And that's every year. So add that up year after year, and you see what a huge international concern and problem this is. In our country, there are 50,000 people that are entering illegal for forced labor or prostitution every single year in this country. And I'm going to talk more about how they get in and what happens. As I said, for organized crime, it's the third largest money maker, so you can imagine that's huge. And they're all hand in hand, and when I talk about the United States, we'll talk about how drugs and gangs and prostitution and all of these activities become enmeshed together. So what does it generate? It generates billions in income. It is a huge business. It is no accident in the United States that prostitution is legal in Nevada, where organized crime flourishes. That is not an accident. It's a huge industry, billions and billions of dollars. And there is no way that the INS and law enforcement can even begin to fight this. They don't have, I think in the city of Chicago, there's two agents that work on trafficking. What do the profits contribute to? What happens with all this money? Guess what? The proliferation and expansion of organized crime. So they get stronger and stronger and better networks. The other thing they use a lot of this money for is the corruption of the officials. So in these smaller countries, these poor countries where the officials, the police, nobody makes any money, guess what? They all get paid off to get involved in this trafficking, and it's a lot more money than anybody could obviously get as a little border guard or whatever you're doing at the airport and security, and they can pay them a lot of money to help. And so this happens in the countries of origin and the countries of passage for people. So internationally, how do we describe, how do we define organized crime? Well, it's major criminal syndicates that we know exist internationally now, gangs, smuggling rings, and then loosely associated networks. And overseas, the major organized crime networks are the Russians, the Eastern Europeans, and the Asian syndicates. And many Asian syndicates have infiltrated, for example, New York and other places like that. And I know sometimes it's really surprising because it seems so far removed from our world that so much of this is going on, but it's going on all the time. In the U.S., it works a little bit differently. It's mostly conducted by gangs, criminal rings, and also loosely connected networks. Gauging the how it works and everything is obviously difficult because, A, it's underground, and no one in the U.S. or the international community is compiling accurate statistics because of the way it operates and the fact that it is criminal activity. And a lot of people, frankly, don't get caught because we don't have people in the INS working on this. The reports, though, that we know in this country that there is this activity in at least 20 states. And what I'm going to do today is I'm going to pass around. We just checked at the post office, and our handouts are being FedExed. So what I'm going to do, they were supposed to be here today, but, you know, I'm going to leave, try and figure out a place where I can leave them for you that we're here today to pick up handouts. But first of all, I'm going to pass this around. This is a map of the United States which clearly outlines which countries are actually trafficking individuals into each part of our country. So it's broken that down to that sophisticated of a level. There are 10 top receiving airports in the United States for traffic victims. O'Hare, where we come from, is in the top five. Probably the top five are LAX, New York, Miami, Denver, and Atlanta are the top five airports. The way some of these networks work, for example, is a girl is kept in a brothel or prostitution, and it's so elaborate that they literally move her from city to city every 4 to 6 weeks for a lot of reasons. A, to confuse her. B, so she doesn't attach to anyone that might help her in some way. C, because men express, or customers, I should say, a desire for different faces, new fresh faces. And these are organized networks in the United States where they're trafficked from city to city to city to major city, which is hooked up with this crime. I'm also going to pass around, which was one of the handout, which is the position paper for the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women. And it talks a little bit about all the different countries and so on. And you can just get a little idea there. The primary source countries for the U.S., as you'll see on the map, are Thailand, Vietnam, China, Mexico, Russia, the Ukraine, and the Czech Republic. And, of course, that is since communism has ended. One of our colleagues, Dan Bigg, is head of Chicago Recovery Alliance, which is a needle exchange program. And now more and more his work is international work to go to these countries where needles, heroin, drugs, and obviously if you think about their location in the world, they're actually closer in closer places to receiving drugs than we are geographically. So there's a lot of AIDS breaking out in these countries, a lot of heroin addiction, a lot of needles, a lot of crime, and a lot of prostitution. So we now, I guess, sadly or happily, are experts at these kinds of problems, and we're actually going to Europe now to consult with them about how to combat some of these very serious social problems. Some of the other smaller providers in this country are Korea, the Philippines, Malaysia, Latvia, Hungary, Poland, Brazil, and the Honduras. So, and those are the big suppliers of people to the United States. That doesn't mean Mexico, you know, all these other smaller countries are involved, but those are the major countries that are sending people here. What we look at, why now? I mean, why is this huge rise in trafficking? And some of the things we know, some just basic social norms are breaking down. I think there's a lot, and that's a totally different topic. We see a lot of things that are going on in the world today that things have definitely changed, but it's a criminal business. And what is criminal? What is crime? What do people feed on? Well, they feed on poverty, despair, war. Look at the war, the breakup of these countries, crisis, and ignorance. So how do they get people to buy in? How does someone step in and become trafficked? Well, they promise wealth. We also now have the globalization of the world economy, which is increasing, which is breaking down borders. And sometimes we hear that in very positive respect, the borders are being broken down. But in this respect, it's very negative, because it allows for crime rings, for people to connect with one another. So there's an increased involvement of people across the borders, trading people. We see a lot of movement from poorer to wealthier countries, which of course is understandable. If you were in a poor country, you would obviously want to go to a wealthier country. And how you're tricked or coerced into that is what I'll talk a little bit about. And we see, again, international crime is expanding its reach. As the borders break down, they break down for organized crime as well. So they're no longer local crime. And this started, as you know, with drug trafficking, where the borders broke down and we began to have, and drug traffickers, relationships with all different countries and set up businesses there. And we see this in trafficking, exactly that same pattern of drug trafficking. The other factors are the continuous exploitation of women and what happens to women in the world. And we see that in Afghanistan, and we see how they're devalued. For example, in China, for the first time in a long time, there are now beginning to be less women than men because we know of forced abortions of women, of female babies being killed upon birth, or simply giving them away to orphanage and so on. There's more intermarriage taking place in small villages. Scientists are seeing a rise in birth defects because of this. And in addition, Chinese women in their teens to their 30s have, it seems to be now, the highest suicide rate in the world. There's some corresponding issue going on with suicide of Chinese women. So we know from Afghanistan and a lot of these other countries that women continue to be devalued. This is really also a woman's rights issue, and to be seen as someone who can be sold. Little girls are actually sold for the price of what we would pay for an inexpensive toaster, and that's not unusual that your child is traded for that. So you see hardship, you see economic dislocations following the collapse of communism. Those are some of the world factors. You see a high demand worldwide for trafficked women and children, for sex tourism, which is flourishing, for sex workers, and for cheap sweatshop labor. As the prices of unionized country go up for our labor, there's a demand for cheap labor and for domestic workers. I mean, there's a story actually in the map that's being, I think, passed around about a girl from Africa that was held in a basement by two African physicians educated in this country in a very flush, posh suburb. The husband was raping her repeatedly. She was living in the basement, and finally, after about 3 years, I believe, of this, she was an illegal. She was sent to, many times also the guise is to wealthier people, that you think you're sending someone to be under these wealthy, prestigious people, and they're going to take the child under the wing and take care of her and get her educated and so on. Well, the man was raping her repeatedly. Finally, one day, in absolute desperation, she ran outside and was seen by a neighbor, and no one knew that she had lived in that basement for 3 years. And that's not an unusual story in this country, and it's very sad to think about. So the fact that the countries of origin and law enforcement is complicit also hampers our ability to catch people and find out what they're doing and get into this bribery and collapse them. So how, you know, if you were in a country and a trafficker approached you, or what do you think would happen? Well, first of all, some people are just out and out kidnapped. There's no conversation, there's no dialogue. They're just grabbed into a car. This is really happening in Albania. And then by boat to Italy. If you come back and want to get the person arrested, you will be killed gangland style because it's organized crime. You will be killed. And law can't help you. If from a distance you run away or you act out or you do anything else, your family will be killed. So there is absolutely nothing you can do if that happens to you. There were two girls, I believe, who went back in Albania, and they literally, the only safe place was to sleep in a police car every night in the police station parking lot to try and protect them in some way. So the other part of why it's hard to catch people is who on earth is going to testify and stand up and do that, because if you're not killed, if you run away, your family will be killed. So some people are just out and out taken, kidnapped forcibly. In other places, you're just out and out sold by your family. So there's no negotiation there either. You're just sold. Sometimes there's a promise you'll be back, or you can make money and send it back to the family. Something like that happens, but you don't have a voice in that either. Sometimes you're lured with job offers. That's kind of the next level. They tell you you're going to be an au pair in a nice country, or you're going to be sometimes an entertainment related thing. You'll be a dancer, you'll be a singer, you'll be a domestic worker. So they're lured into it with that kind of idea. And of course, the ever-present marriage opportunity, you know, that you will marry someone in another country. We're selling you to be a bride and you'll have a rich husband and, you know, all your troubles will be over and so on and so forth. Now, what's a little bit nice about that the people have actually come knowingly knowing their brides and end up with abusive, domineering, men as husbands. There's a lot of legal activity going on now and legal advocacy to help them divorce these abusive men and actually get alimony, which is even nicer to their citizens. So it's not sometimes what this guy bargained for, that he's going to have control over this woman for the rest of his life. And people have figured out how to start combating that once they're legally married, but you have to be legally married. They also, this is how distinct it is, they advertise in newspapers and they actually set up employment agencies, phony employment agencies. So someone from Russia might read the ad, come in, I want to be an au pair in the United States, and that's where she really thinks she's going. Now, I have to say this, there are some, but a minority, who know that sex will be involved. That is the minority of the women, but then also it is a way, a means to an end. They might say, well, I'll just do this for a little while till I get into another country, and then I'll get out of it, which normally that doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. Also, as I said, in terms of buying, they approach the families directly, and they just say, will you sell that girl? Mm-hmm. I have to also tell you, some of the ages for sex exploitation are as young as 7, 5, that had been sold into slavery, and there was also someone who was just caught in California a few years ago. He was from a Mideastern country, he was a wealthy businessman there, and he had charges, I guess you would say, and they thought they were sending, you know, under his direction, and they would get a chance at an education in California, and he was having sex with girls as young as 7 years old, and was a pillar of the community. I think it was outside of Los Angeles, and he was finally exposed for what he was doing to these little girls. You know, it's enraging. I see the expression on your face, it's like, oh. Sometimes they tell them they'll provide the transportation, they'll do all the documentation to help them get this job in the new country. And then sometimes they continue to charge fees. Once they get you into prostitution, it's like, well, you just have to give us so much of your, and then we'll let you out, and so much of your fees, and then we'll let you out. Then sometimes they, again, tell the parents or the family in the country of origin, well, if you give us so much money, we'll let her out. So essentially, once you enter into this contract, knowingly or unknowingly, you're kept in bondage for, you know, a long, long time, indiscriminate amount of time. Sometimes they actually also target beauty contest winners, just like the United States, where we target our beauty contest winners. And unlike the U.S., where you actually may get an opportunity to put out a record or, you know, be on a game show or whatever happens to beauty contest winners. In this case, they're telling them that's going to happen, but it doesn't happen. They're forced to be dancers. And then a lot of, even in the United States, a lot of dancers and so on end up in prostitution. There's also word of mouth in smaller villages. The smaller villages know when the recruiters come, and they're known, and it's so-and-so is here. To recruit, and is there anybody who wants to give their daughter today or whatever, and they pick them up and take them for money. The other thing that's happening with the proliferation of international trafficking is the internet. The internet is, while it's a gift, again, these things are always double-edged swords, it's a huge boon to pornography and the sex industry in this, not only in this country, but globally. It promotes global trafficking, where there's actual descriptions of where the sex hotels are, pictures of the girls, what the different girls, what her techniques are, what she might do for you, and so on. And you can sort of pick where you go in these countries. In Israel, they actually showed, and these are countries that are supposed to be human rights countries, but of course, another thing I want to mention, people talk about Amsterdam and legalization, and the reality is if you go to Amsterdam and see what's going on there, most of those girls are from other countries. They're not from Amsterdam. You'll see a lot of Asian women, you won't see a lot of girls from Amsterdam because it's more acceptable to bring other women in from other countries. Anyway, in Israel, they actually got into one, and they had them sort of on bleachers like they were in a zoo, sort of. And they were behind glass, sitting on bleachers and posing, and the men walked in this kind of aisle around them, and then from whatever they were doing on the bleacher, they would pick out, you know, which one they went. And often these girls have to have as many as 25 men a day and actually have that activity in the small room where they also have to live. So just think for a moment what that would do to you psychologically, what kind of an environment that must be for you. The outcomes. What are the outcomes? You know, what is happening? Well, first of all, most of these women are under the age of 25 to the late teens. As I said, some as young as 7. When they get here, they endure mental abuse, physical abuse. They're kept in servitude. They're often beaten, raped. They're starved. Many times they begin forced drug use until the person does become addicted. So they're forcibly injected so that they start to, you know, be able to go along more with what they want. They're confined and they're secluded. And also, as you know, these are all techniques for brainwashing. So, you know, they're put in this environment. Their passports are confiscated, if they had them, and they're isolated. They have forced sex with a large number of partners, and one of the ways they keep tabs on this is to count condoms. And you have to have so many used condoms there, and then they can say, well, you had 25 partners. Often there's unprotected sex. If the customer absolutely refuses, they're forced to have unprotected sex. And of course, very long hours. Then you put yourself, there's health risks. And remember, these are health risks that are spread to the society, all other communities. Sexually transmitted disease, we're seeing a big resurgence of hepatitis C in this country, and obviously HIV and AIDS, people get at risk. Then, of course, you have mental breakdowns. You have people that just simply can't take it, and that you have all kinds of psychological and emotional problems that develop from, and you can imagine someone who comes from this small village somewhere, and then suddenly this becomes their life. Some are actually just brutalized to death, beaten to death, strangled if they want to run away, all manners, and that happens in this country too, and I'm going to talk about that. Prostitutes are often killed, and whoever kills them is not caught or even sometimes looked for. And sometimes when they get very ill, they're not going to take these girls to the hospital, these girls who are here illegally. So sometimes they just die of an untreated illness, and that's okay. I want to tell you about a true story, and there's hundreds of this, but I picked this one up. Her name's Marie Isabel Chalandana Dia. She was a 15-year-old virgin in Veracruz, Mexico. The smugglers came to her town and told her parents, you know, we'll take her to a migrant farm in Florida and she can be a picker. And they agreed, you know, that she could be a picker and she could come back and she'd stay there, whatever, and she would send the money back to her family. Instead of picking when she got there, she was locked in a room and she was gang raped. And she was gang raped over and over and over again until she was completely desensitized. And then they told her that she would be the prostitute for the migrant farm workers. So she now had to sleep with as many as 25 or more men in a day and night. And she had forced abortions because some of them refused to wear condoms, beatings and threats. They told her if she ran away, they would say that she had stolen money, and not only was she illegal, she was a criminal, and that they would have her prosecuted. This went on until the FBI, with Border Patrol raids, actually found her and discovered this reprehensible crime. But now think about this. Here we have this girl now. She had a 2-year-old by someone she didn't know. And found that when she was finally found, she was again pregnant again with a second child she didn't know the father of. She's been raped and abused, and now she's supposed to go back to Veracruz. What possible life or quality of life might wait for her back in her hometown when she returns in this condition? So that's another one of the human rights issues. If people are going to be helped, and with absolutely probably no intervention on the psychological, psychiatric, she was just deported. And there's been a lot of work about T visas, which are trafficked visas, to try and at least figure out a way to hold people until they can be debriefed, receive some help, some emotional services. And it might be you have to go back to Mexico City. And perhaps we can provide some way financially for you to get in a place where you can get lost a little more easily than this small town where you may never, ever have a chance at a real life or a real happiness when you're branded and labeled like that in a town like this. So in addition to the other laws that I talked about today, what else is international trafficking a violation of? Well, there are real laws on the books if they could be enforced. Labor laws, immigration laws, kidnapping laws, slavery laws, false imprisonment, assault, battery, pandering, fraud with force or coercion. So I wanted to today, I just show you, and we're going to talk tomorrow, I'm really going to talk about what happens when they get here. This was a recent parade where it says who will stand up for them. And it really talks about the children who come here, and they actually have, it's really almost, it's so pathetic. Here's, at age two, here's a two-year-old who's detained by the INS in prison, who was given away by his parents. But it really starts to talk about the fact that when they get here, we have absolutely nothing to help them, no mechanisms in place. So whatever they're kidnapped or taken for. And we'll talk about the actual experience when they get here and also start to begin to look at the real causes, sociology around prostitution, what happens to our kids, our inability to protect children, why we're not in this society. And I think a lot of it is, whenever it's this reprehensive, it's really hard for people to really face what's going on with kids, to face sexual abuse of kids. I think that's why, and believe me, the Catholic priests, by no means, even though they were single out, are the only people, you know, abusing kids in this country. I mean, it is absolutely rampant, and this is why we have DCFS and, you know, taking kids away all the time and all this. But this is a rampant problem, not only in our country, but internationally. And we might want to think about why. You know, why are children so unprotected, even though we value them and we place them on a high plane? If you're from a healthy family, God bless you, but there's so many people in this world that simply are not from healthy families. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And I'm going to pass around a few articles which are coming. This one's called Girls Entering Sex Trade May Say It's a Choice, but Experts See Them as Victims of Master Manipulations. Talks about what happens. This is called Childhood Abuse and Future Implications. Pathways to Prostitution, the Chronology of Sexual and Drug Abuse Milestones. Antecedents to Prostitution. How does someone end up there? You know, little girls want to be movie stars or spacemen or doctors or lawyers or singers. I don't think many little girls say, you know, when I grew up, I'd really like to be giving blowjobs on my knees for $20. I think that's a really great idea for me when I grow up. Nobody grows up thinking that's what they want to be. So what happened? What happened? And we'll talk a little bit more about that, and I hope some of those articles will be available. Up here today, and we have a limited, each workshop's going to have, I have the information on Genesis House. If anybody wants to take that with you, I have about five per workshop of these, and this has the Time magazine article in it, describes our services, has information about our website. We have a website, www.genesishouse.org, and it talks a lot about our services. But if anybody, I'll leave these up here, and if anybody wants to take one to see a little bit about our programming, I'll leave those here today. And I just wondered if anybody had any questions for discussion or anything they wanted to talk about today.
How did these women come into the United States? How are they brought in?
Well, I'm going to talk a lot about that tomorrow, but it's an elaborate network around airports and other kinds of places where they're brought in. And basically two big places are the Canadian border and the Mexican border. If they don't actually come in through our airports, they come in over those borders. And they're both huge, giant borders that can't really be patrolled in the real world. So.
Who has partnered with you besides, you know, you're affiliated with UN?
We're in Chicago. We work with the INS and then the Coalition Against International Trafficking, and the INS and sometimes the Coalition aren't totally on the same page, but we work with with both of them. And there are some people, the big concern right now is that because of legal issues, they actually need to be housed. But unless you're going to testify, you're deported. So it's a real sticky wicket, and that's where there's a lot of work being done around T visas and how we can keep people who don't want to testify and do some kind of intervention before they're deported. Because oftentimes the INS will tell you, they bust the ring and they see the girls going up the back stairs to go back to where they were because they don't have anywhere to go. They don't know what to do. They don't speak English. They don't have any money. And there's nobody saying, okay, here, we've just broken up this prostitution ring. Now here, you can go to this safe place. And that is actually the service they would like Genesis House to provide in Chicago is housing. But it would have to, you know, obviously it takes a significant amount of money. It takes translators. It takes all kinds of, because in Chicago, you're dealing with every kind of culture and race you can imagine. With that, so it's a huge project, and we are trying to get some funding around getting emergency housing for when they're actually pulled out of the brothel. You know, this is not street prostitution, by the way. It's the illegal women are normally very hidden. They're in brothels. That's another reason. It might be in a storefront in a neighborhood where they only speak Serbian, and you know, to figure out that's going on there is very difficult because nobody in the neighborhood's going to tell you that. So you're going to have to infiltrate that with someone who won't be noticed in the neighborhood who speaks the language and figures out that's going on. So a lot of it is collaboration with the community agencies, you know, the Polish American agency, the Japanese American agency. We try and collaborate because they will tend to find out what's going on in those neighborhoods. And that's how you have to work, you know, because each little, you know, in Chicago, each little section has some type of organization that they're working with their people and they know what's going on. But also even the one Chinese woman came to me who was a counselor and because of the cultural issues was trying to, if she could confront the man about sexually abusing, I think it was his granddaughter or something, because in her country she would not be allowed to do that as a woman. And there's a lot of literature about how do we approach where they think it's culturally okay, you know, to be doing that, and the women aren't allowed to say anything. And then here we are in the United States where it's obviously illegal, and how do you work with that? Because she was literally afraid to say anything to him because she said, I know they'll never come back if I say a word, and I'm not supposed to, I'm a woman. So even in those agencies, there's this real, what do I do when I find that out? Other questions?
Yes? I'm wondering, you said that they die of an illness or were beaten to death or strangled, some of them. So where are the bodies?
Well, I think just like with our prostitution, our country, they find them in garbage bags on belts, they find them in dumpsters, they find them in water, you know, just any place people dispose of bodies. You know, we worked with the FBI in Chicago on the serial. There were serial killers there. And we knew one woman who was our client, and she used to serve construction workers in Uptown. And it's an area in Chicago, Uptown. And she was found with barbed wire around her neck. So we all assumed it was construction work. And when you think about that here, I mean, there's lots of these people walking around that'll never get caught that are killers. I mean, they're murderers. And, you know, he was never caught. And so they just found somebody face down in the water, actually, we have three locations at our south side location, and she had been bruise marks on her neck, and our organization was rallying around that and confronting the police, and they said that she tried to drown herself, and it was like, you know, come on. So we had to be advocates because, you know, a lot of times they don't have families or friends that are advocates. Yeah, and it was real shallow water, you know. Like, well, what are these bruises on our neck? But also, Chicago's become the murder capital of the United States, for those of you who aren't enlightened about that. We are in Chicago. And they also are trying to keep the murder rates down, so because it looks so bad. So if it's someone that nobody's going to complain about or nobody's going to say, well, we disagree with that finding that we say she was murdered, they'll just put it as a drowning because they're trying to change that statistic right now, too.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions. You were saying that in Nevada, prostitution is legalized. How does like gambling, does that have any correlations between gambling and prostitution? Because there's an awful lot of proliferation in our state of Native American gambling. And I'm just concerned as a citizen with the organized crime possibilities of coming into that. And then my other question is, you were talking about you have a 70% success rate?
Yes.
So what do you feel are your reasons that your system is so successful?
Well, I'm going to talk about that on Friday.
But I'll just Friday.
Okay. I will say it's not neural surgery.
Yeah.
It's that most programs are run by bureaucrats, mm-hmm. people that don't understand what the needs are. Most drug programs are fueled by the insurance industry. So we created this very independent program that meets the needs of the person in a holistic way, including spirituality, from spirituality to dental work to job training, mm-hmm. to 12-step to psychotherapy to trauma survivor, to helping you get a house, to not permitting you to work for 6 months while you get healthy and get well and work on yourself. So it's really pretty basic. Unfortunately, it's not done because we have to scramble for every nickel we get because we are not beholden to anybody. You know, Medicaid or Medicare or Social Security, nobody controls us in that sense. So we can do that, but it's hard to get funding. But when I do talk about it, I'll tell you that there's other models in the country with the same success rate who do the very similar things, which is meeting the needs of the individual and understanding that years of abuse and victimization and substance abuse and horrific childhoods are not cured in 21 or 28 days. Yeah. That is a fantasy. Yeah. That is not going to happen. Yeah. And, you know, after 21 or 28 days, you say, okay, well, now you go home now, back to like where your uncle was on top of you for 7 years, and there's a crack house on the corner which you have to pass, and you still need teeth, and you still need job training, and you still need health insurance, and come back for outpatient, okay? And we'll see how well that works. It's, you know, you have to be taken out of that environment, be put in a safe place, you know, with lots of support, 24 hours a day. People helping you. And even at that, if you do that in 12 to 14 months, that's miraculous that you overcome all that horrible stuff, you know, in 12 to 14 months. It's a miracle, you know. And I challenge anybody here, you know, who lives that lifestyle, that you could do that. Anybody who does that, you know, it's God working through people, and that's how He works. And we provide the opportunity for that to happen, but there's lots of basic, sane things that have to happen that don't happen in programs in this country. They just don't. And Ted Koppel did one in California. He said, and the way he put it, we could actually put someone through Harvard, which I like, because I always talk about the money, as to keep her locked up for a year. We could have put her through Harvard, but we'd rather lock up people.
Yeah.
You know, and these women are nonviolent offenders. I mean, they're highly rehabable, and this program in California had, bingo, surprise, a 70% success rate. And I was like, gee, what a surprise. You know, same basic idea, and I'll talk a lot about this, it's much cheaper than incarcerating people. It's much cheaper, it's less than 50% of the cost. Incarceration has an 80% recidivism rate. We have a 70% success rate. So it's very sane, it's very fiscally sound, it's very humane, but we are just lock up crazy in this country. We're just like, well, let's lock them all up, let's get them all away from us. You know, we're really destroying the fabric of our society now by having nearly 2% of our population incarcerated. I mean, it's higher than most civilized countries, and, you know, this 50% of people that are incarcerated end up having incarcerated kids. So we're, you know, nobody's, it's just like we're so lockup crazy that we don't even see all the horrible social ramifications of what we're doing right now. 75% of our women have children under the age of 18. What happens to those kids? I mean, just start thinking about all this stuff, you know. They end up in some foster care. About half the foster care homes are okay. Some are not very okay. Some horrible things happen. You know, one of our graduates who actually made this necklace, Eileen, who's very well now and designs jewelry, was taken into foster homes. Her mother was an alcoholic, and that's where she was abused. all the horribly abused this girl. And you know, we also provide free forever follow-up services, forever. You want to come, you have a counselor, you're having a crisis, you need a bag of food, you got fat, your clothes don't fit anymore, and you need a new wardrobe to go to work. We provide that for you so we can always be your family and your support system forever. And you don't have to say, you know, sit down over there. And that's where spiritual roots come in. You know, I'm sorry, she's gone for the day. You'll have to come back in 2 days. That is not allowed in our organization. If you come in that door, then someone's going to talk to you that day. Or, of course, then you will have to talk to me if you don't talk to them that day. So there's a lot of things. If you walk in the door and you say, you know, I want to give up drugs, okay, stay here safe with us. Now, we don't have a bed for 3 weeks. You know what? We'll put you up on the couch. We'll put you up in a sleeping bag. We will keep you there. And see, a lot of programs are so rigid and bureaucratic. We'll say, okay, and we'll feed you and we'll support you. We'll take you there. You know, Wanda, where's Wanda? God bless her heart. Wanda will take you there and make sure you get to the door. That's very different. But that's really what it takes, is to be a little less, you know, rigid and a lot more flexible. Because people aren't, you know, like that. And especially when you come in and you've been prostituting and using drugs, you're not really at a place where it's like, okay, I'll be back tomorrow. And, you know, come on now. It's just like when we did that to the mentally ill, and we put all the mentally ill out of institutions, and then they became frozen people in doorways in Chicago with their toes being cut off. Because you're supposed to go to, you know, you're raging psychotic, and you're supposed to go, you know, get your medication on the first at Cook County Hospital. You have nowhere to live, you're sleeping in a doorway, and you haven't had your medication for 3 weeks, and you're supposed to show up there. It's ridiculous. You know, so we don't provide safety nets. We provide the extreme, the prison, the mental hospital, you know, whatever it might be, but the safety net part that actually gets you well is where in this country we're really not good, you know, at all.
Why do you think that is?
I think the insurance industry fuels treatment programs, and that's why they're 21 or 28 days. I think there is a prevailing paranoia about getting people away from me, you know, get them away and then I'll be safe if you've committed a crime. I think that's kind of a mentality as well. And I think no matter that you show that it's fiscally more sound to do this, I mean, we compared, I was a healthcare administrator at the time, and we compared ER and ICU costs of a homeless person as opposed to keeping them in a safe house. It's the same difference, you know. They, with people that check in every day, mental health workers, and say, you know, are you taking your medication, Bob? Are you okay, Bob? Are you eating food, Bob? Do you need to go out? Can I, you know, what do you need? Do you want to go to a movie? A fraction of the cost of somebody ending up in your emergency room or your ICU. So I think it's just, it's a frustration because it's almost the way the government works and thinks. It's a punitive. It's from the English system of social welfare. We're based on the English system of social welfare, which is a very paternal system. And they've done experiments about actually if you give people food stamps or you give them money, and people who are going to be frugal and do the right thing will do the same thing with money as they will with food stamps. And people that are going to sell food stamps for other things will sell it anyway. It doesn't matter. You could just as easily give them money. But we think we have some check and balance when we give them food stamps. But it's actually pretty meaningless. But I think it goes back to that English social welfare system that all of our social welfare systems are based on. And just the huge, and also the other dynamic is that incarcerating people is a huge industry, as we know. So you come to this little industrial town where the industry is not there anymore because they moved to Guatemala where the labor is cheaper to exploit other people. So the factory's empty and you say, you know what, we're going to revitalize your community. Let's build a prison. Instead of like, let's put on a show, let's build a prison. And so we're going to have to pay for bricks, and we're going to have to pay the construction workers, and we're going to have to pay for uniforms. And then there's going to be an ongoing payment of buying food and employing people. And this whole little industry comes around that prison and revitalizes the town. You know, now like in the Southwest where they have all the lands, they have actual, you know, sister prisons. So if a prison's overflowed in one state, like when you can go to the prison in Arizona where they've got more land and more room now. And that's so there's money being made in incarcerated people by, and jobs being created too.
Yeah, up here.
Yeah. Oh, hi.
Hi. When I was living in Aberdeen, Washington, which was a kind of an economically depressed, very economically depressed town, that was, they were involved in competing for prison. And that was viewed, just like you said, this was the salvation of the town.
Mm-hmm. And it's, and you know, it's really, because I go to Washington several times a year, and a lot of our funding does come through the Congressional Black Caucus, and it is really like pulling teeth just to get people to hear the message about healthy programming and successful programming. Because the old, and I think it's another thing, where you have this network of systems that are there, and you're trying to rattle up and change that. You know, you're trying to change the way people view recovery and all of that kind of thing, and what's helpful. And just to, like, you're, you know, you're dealing with such old systems that have been in place for so long. And what we have to go into now, a lot for us, is a lot of research and publishing and just try. I actually hired just someone who's a research associate to try and start showing, and you know, that this works, and what the financial gain and the social gain. But I can really tell you, it's when the women were being murdered in Chicago, and I went down to Springfield, which is our capital, and testified about getting domestic violence money. It was just, you know, it's fighting for every nickel. And I think traditionally, not only incarceration, but I think that you're competing with kids that are ill, and you're competing with senior citizens that need food, and there's all these things. And I think some groups and people just become the most marginalized in society, which is another thing. And you have to really show, and I think because there's been so few movements to help them, there's not a lot of literature supporting. So that's kind of the other thing.
Well, and they're women. If it was the other way around,
yeah,
it would have been taken care of a long time ago. And as long as men are still out there buying prostitution, it's going to, you're never going to be able to wipe it out by taking the prostitutes off the street. There's always more family life and whatever's forcing them out there on the street. You have to stop it from the other end.
Well, that's, we're trying to do in Chicago a John's program, which there are in many places in the United States, which actually looks at it like it's not only her problem, it's his problem. You know, because if you see who's in our town picking up prostitutes, it's the guys who live in the nice suburbs, you know, who go, you know, it's you know, with some exceptions, but and goes home. You know, and I was, they used to, before I got there, they actually let our women be on talk shows where they were really not treated well. And a lot of times you'd see these women, you know, raving, and oh, you're bad, you're horrible, you know, whatever. And I'd say, go home and yell at your husband. You know, don't yell at them. This is a supply and demand situation. And actually, you're right, it's so discriminatory that depending on the city in the United States, either 5-1, the prostitute's arrested to the man, all the way up to 10-1. Now, why it's even more discriminatory is in Chicago, for example, when we impound cars and we do all that stuff, we get $674 in that neighborhood from this guy, you know, with all the fines and everything and taking his car. It contributes $1 million to the general fund in Chicago annually. Mm-hmm. All right, now, we're letting 5 or 8 of those guys go. Every arrest. The woman who is arrested, on the other hand, is costing us money. She's costing us in booking and police time and judge time and jail time and blah, 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 blah. She costs us money. We make money off of him. Yet, we let him go. We say, you know, we don't want to see you in this neighborhood again. Take your BMW somewhere else. You know, don't be here. So, look how discriminatory that is. Not only is she costing us, he's making money for us. We could have $10 million annually. I mean, I've actually, many years, as Ingrid well knows, tried to get my hands on that money in the city of Chicago, at least half of it, because I feel it should go to rehabbing the women, those fines. And I'm still working on it. You know, it's an uphill battle. And but you're right, it's very discriminatory. But the other thing is, there are many men who do want help. And when they go through these Johns programs, they realize that they have issues with sexual compulsivity slash addictions and other kinds of issues. And it's actually, we have these Victorian things which aren't healthy, where in a lot of this, we could even have a lot of talks about sexuality and why our country's so unhealthy about sexuality. But it's like, let's print his name, and, you know, let's shame him, which is like that old Victorian stuff. When in reality, at the other end, surprising to most people, a lot of these guys who go through John's program, the one in San Francisco, has a 90-some percent success rate, where they are actually offered therapy and help and education, and we find out what happened to them in their childhood. Like they sat in the car while their father was with a prostitute. You know, and they thought that was the way to grow up and that was the way to be. So, you know, as we want to treat the women humanely, and, you know, and I'm not talking about traffickers and organized crime and kidnappers, you know, this guy is probably someone that doesn't want to destroy his family life and his home and all of that, and just might need help. But the way we treat it is so punitive and so, you know, just humiliating to him. Like, how is he going to want help after that? Of course he's not going to want help after that. You know, he's going to hide and run. And the other thing is, we did a random study in Chicago, one of the female police lieutenants and I, we just threw in all the guys arrested for prostitution and what else they'd been arrested for. 50% came up with other violent crimes. So mostly domestic violence and some and battery kinds of charges and violent charges. So it's also a way to nip, you know, to kind of find someone who's an offender, most likely will hurt a woman somewhere, a prostitute, who's also maybe hurting somebody at home who has big time issues, and to pull him out of the pool and get him some help, you know, before he continues to hurt. And that was 50% at a random sample, which was, I think, extremely surprising. And that's not routinely done, too, with rap sheets, just to say, you know, you're arrested for this, 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 and this, let's pull you out, and would this Johns program at the point. And it could be set up just like a DUI, you know, very simple. The systems are in place. You know, you get arrested for DUI, you go to a classroom, you get this help, and then you're offered continuing counseling. So we've got all the systems in place for this. But again, you know, those are the social mores. It's, you know, my dad, my first sexual experience with my dad. I grew up on the Mexican border, and that was very routine, you know, that the guys went, you know, to a brothel in Mexico for their first or early sexual experience, and that was just totally accepted. And there was a high school, what's the name of that one in Lincoln Park? Where your son went. What is it? The high school your son went to, the school.
Oh, yeah. Francis Parker?
Francis Parker had a pimp ho day until fairly recently, and this is a nice private school. Oh. And when I was on, I was interviewed on WGN a few months ago with a girl from Francis Parker who finally the girls had risen up recently and said, this is really not cool. You know, we don't like this. But it was like, it's institution, that's it, with the current music and all the rap music, some of the, I mean, I've seen like suburban kids with a cologne called Pimp, you know, and they're splashing it on, you know, and they think it's really, it's a men's, it's a little boy's cologne that the eighth graders wear, and they think it's a really cool cologne. So, yeah, it's like accepting girls being, women being called hoes in music, and being degraded, and kids learning that and thinking it's cool to be called a pimp. I mean, there's tons of that going on right now. You know, and that just continues negative attitudes about women and sexuality too, and then also fosters unhealthy sexuality. So that kid's going to be driving around in a car looking for a girl when he's 21. You know, it just fosters that stuff. And because of the way the school system is, we tried to start a program in school systems about healthy sexuality, and it's like, it's abstain. And it's kind of like, we had actually written a program, we wanted to go in and do it, because I do speak in schools, sometimes just to touch with kids, and I'll say, if you know anybody in this room that's being abused, it's, and you know it's them. And I can't tell you many girls line up and ask for my card and say, well, it's my cousin or it's my friend. And I say, call me, here's my private line and I will try and help you. Because it's at all socioeconomic levels where, you know, I said, do you know someone who's, you know, someone male in the family hurting them or doing something to them? There's nothing like that going on in schools. Even though the statistics show sex earlier, pregnancy earlier, everything, there's nothing. We're just supposed to teach them to abstain in you know, that's just not, you know, and then we foster, you know, and then where's the, and then unhealthy sexuality runs amok, and I mean, the current rapes of little girls and murders, I mean, there's just so much that needs to be done in that area. And just getting your foot in the door there. I mean, adults go to all these sexuality workshops, but, you know, kids, there's so much unhealthy stuff bombarding them every day on the internet and on TVs and music. And we're not combating that nearly equally with healthy attitudes about loving and sexuality.
Did you say it was a John's program in Chicago?
No, we have a proposal into the city of Chicago based on actually the San Francisco model from SAGE, which I went last summer and spent the day there and got to know. I even got to read the feedback sheets from the men and what they had learned in the program. And then they monitor it for a year to see if they're rearrested, and they're not normally rearrested. And then there's a male, usually counselor there with sexual issues, who can hook them up with further counseling if after the class they want that. And it's been a really successful program. And Minnesota has one, and Canada. Lots of places in the U.S. are actually starting them. We haven't yet, but we're trying to.
So in the place where the John program is the prostitution rate going down, or is it still the same? Because I know that prostitute going to still be the prostitute, but...
Well, I think SAGE is also a prostitution program like we are.
Okay.
And that's an interesting question, because it's funny you should say that. The police said to me, and the detectives when I was trying to negotiate this program, they said, well, Gail, when we take their cars, the rate goes down too. And so I said, I'm sure it does. They said, they don't want their car taken. I said, yes, but it's not an intervention that's going to prevent him from doing it again. It's also not an intervention that sort of nips whatever his issues are. Because, you know, we should be dealing with what happened to the prostitute and what's up with him, too. Mm-hmm. You know, not only men are customers, but they're predominantly men. I mean, there are some female customers, and there are transgender prostitutes, but that's a whole other topic about all kinds of different forms of sexuality. But it's mostly men. But, I don't know, I would imagine if less men are going out there, but you're right, I mean, there's always going to be someone to replace the old one until there's bigger work.
Right.
Are there any other questions today? Well, I really thank you for coming. I hope that tomorrow it's 10:45. I don't remember on Thursday, and then as I said, Friday will be all about Genesis House. And if any of our women want to talk about it, they'll stand up and tell about their personal experience in that final workshop. So thank you.